Science is what we are discussing today. If you've got a question about the world around you, usually things can be explained by science. So give us a call, 1300 0555 36. We'd love to hear something that we don't hear every week. I know that it's hard to come up with original questions, but I have faith in you, Australia, and we're going to go straight to Sarah, who's calling in from the Mornington Peninsula. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, guys.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm just wondering if you think humans will evolve to not store excess fat on their bodies due to having readily available foods. Parts of the world that do.
Well, Dr. Sarah, evolution is still happening. It happened 7,000 years ago with the ability to have milk, and 4,000 years ago in Africa to have milk as an adult. It happened more recently in high altitude areas in the Himalayas, Andes, and Africa to be able to deal with oxygen, and we're still having evolution going on now. However, it is a bad evolutionary move to not be able to store fat, because if it turns out that you miss out on a meal, you could well run into the dreaded, oh my God, hangry, where you might become, let's just say, mildly irritable, a fire-breathing dragon. So you want to be able to store some fat. The other side of the coin is this. We no longer think of fat, and by the way, there's two sorts of fat. White fat, which is what I'm talking about. Brown fat, don't even think about it. That keeps babies warm. We used to think of white fat as just this sort of dumb storage area that was just like a drum and you filled it up and you took it out again. We now know that it is metabolically active. Fat is an essential part of being alive and having a healthy system. And so there are different fat levels for men and women. And you see this especially in the bodybuilders who, when they go down to the below 10%, below 5%, they do things like stand up suddenly and then just faint, or go into a shower and the hot water opens up their blood vessels and they faint. So we need some fat. I can't see it in any way being an advantage to not have some fat.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Thank you.
See you later,
Thank
Sarah.
You, Dr. Sarah.
What sort of percentage? What's the minimum percentage that we need of body fat? Do you know?
5 or 6, you start fainting, and that's really, really low. I think men are about 15 to 20 something, and women are about 20 to a little bit higher.
Right.
And honestly, it's part of your normal life to have that fat. Mm. It is you. It is delicious.
Delicious fat. That's what we're talking about this morning with Dr. Carl. Let's head now to Brett, who's calling in from the Central Coast. Hey, Brett, what's your question?
Morning, Doctor. How are we?
Good.
Dr. Brett.
I read somewhere a couple of weeks ago that a Japanese company have created a device that could transfer dreams into a video playback. Just wondering if that's even possible, and if it is, are we able to do it backwards and sort of implant them into our own mind?
Oh, my gosh.
Inception is what he's talking about.
Yeah, you're right ahead of the curve there. Okay, so just backing off a little bit here. It's kind of like standing outside a music venue, hearing the music, and then trying to work out not just what the music is, but what colour shoes the second guitarist is playing. That's the layers that exist between us picking up electrical signals off the skull and the actual content of the dreams. And so we can begin to get patterns, and so it might well be that you're worried about something at work, so you, in your dream you spend a lot of time mowing the lawn or surfing, and if you have a very characteristic pattern, which is if we wake you up and you say, I was surfing or mowing the lawn, and then we see that pattern later, we can then say, okay, in your dream you are now surfing or mowing the lawn. We can go a little bit better than that, but certainly not being able to get to the stage where we can say, oh, look at that, he did something unexpected and then turned himself into an aeroplane with wheels and then burrowed into the ground. We can't do that. And the next stage of implanting, long way down the line, long way.
Good question, though. Thanks for the call, Brett.
Thank you, Dr. Brett.
Thank you.
Let's head along to Adelaide, where Renee's on the line. Morning, Renee. What's your question?
Good morning, doctors. My question is, what is the difference between genetic modification and cross-pollination?
Okay. So genetic modification allows you to do what nature's doing anyway, but a lot further. So if you go for a walk in springtime in the fields and you see all these grass plants growing tall, you know, just like the normal lawn grass, and you see these long strands about, you know, 30, 40, 50 centimetres, maybe even a metre long, and right at the end there are these tiny little seeds that are about a bit bigger than the head of a pin. That's corn. So in Central America, they modified those. They genetically bred them to turn them from tiny little seeds into corn. And nature could have done it by itself, or we can force it along without genetic therapy. We could just do it by crossbreeding and crossbreeding. But then if you want to have a tomato that is resistant to frost, so that if the temperature drops down to zero, it doesn't automatically frost up. It might have to go to, say, -3, and it gives you just a significantly higher output, if you're a tomato farmer, of tomatoes that were not damaged. But what you do is that with genetic modification, you breed in a gene from a fish. Now, there's no way that a tomato is going to love a fish very much in a special way and you know, send the genes across. So genetic modification enables us to do what nature can do in some cases a lot quicker, and sometimes what nature just can't do because you were crossing species. So far, we've seen no problems with the genetically modified tomatoes, but they don't taste that good. But really, you've got to have homegrown tomatoes to get the good taste anyway. Is that kind of a start, Dr. Renee?
Yeah, definitely a start there.
Thanks for the call, Renee.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Renee.
Thank you.
Let's head to Miles in Melbourne with a delightful question. Thank you for bringing the world of farts into our lives, Miles.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for taking my call. Appreciate
Thank
that.
You.
What's your question?
I work with this workmate called Emil Schmid, and he's just got...
Hang on a minute. No name and shame, please.
Thank you. Yep.
That's not what you're... You're not using this to diss someone. Let's just ask the science question.
Yep.
And he's just got the most potent farts ever, and I work in pretty close proximity with him. And I was just wondering how many farts it would take to actually kill a person, if that's possible.
I feel like Niles' motivation is coming from a different place, but let's answer his question scientifically, because we're professionals, Dr.
We're professionals. Okay, so with regard to killing, you're looking at bringing the oxygen level from 20% down to, say, 10% or so. You can still survive at 16, which is the level of oxygen, the percentage of oxygen that comes out of your lungs, and that's good enough for somebody who's drowning to bring him back with mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. 10%, you're pretty close to the border, so that means halving the concentration of carbon of oxygen in the atmosphere. Okay, working out that, you do about half a litre of farts a day in total, and you're in a tiny room which is 2 metres by 2 metres by 2 metres. That's 8 cubic metres. That's 8,000 litres. That's six. You would need 16,000 farts.
Oh, that's 16, a lot.
16,000 days worth of farts.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's 3,000 days... there's 1,000 days to 3 years, so you'd need 45 years worth of farts in one room to bring the oxygen concentration down to half and therefore kill another person. Other than that, it's just simply the smells that you're not liking and you're saying it's killing me. You're being metaphorical rather than literal.
Thanks, Miles.
Thank you, Dr. Miles.
Cheeky Miles.
Cheeky boy.
45 days it would take. I mean, I'm glad.
45 years.
45 years.
45 years of
in a closed
farts.
Room. Like, that's a long time.
It is, and you'd have to have them in that room all the time. They'd get bored. You know, can I go for a swim? No. Breathe the low concentration air. Can I go and see my wife?
I feel like that if you were stuck in a room for 45 years and someone was farting, boredom would be the least of your worries. Nathan's joining us from Repton. Hey, Nathan, what's your question for Dr. Carl?
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. My friend, lover, consort, she can't go to the toilet in the morning doing number twos after making love.
And, is that
normal vaginal sex, not anything else?
Mm. And is that making love in the morning or in the evening?
In the morning.
And for how long is the delay before she's then able to have a number two, as we technically call it in the trade?
Several hours.
Right. Okay, there's some sort of neural inhibition, which I haven't heard of, but which is part of normal. What happens in males is you have the inability to urinate immediately after sex because there's a Y sort of valve, shaped like the letter Y, and you can either have prostatic fluid or urine coming through it, and you just have to wait for the valve to switch over. Happening in women with difficulty in urination, never heard of it. With regard to the bowel motions being slowed down, almost certainly there's some sort of crossover onto the nerves, which is stopping, and here's a technical term, gut motility, M-O-T-I-L-I-T-Y. I haven't heard of it. I'm sure it does happen as part of the variation of normal. I'll have to go looking it up.
Thanks for the call, Nathan.
Thank you.
Let's head now to Michael calling in from Brizzy. Hey, Michael, what's your question?
Just wondering why mozzies don't go for open wounds.
You would think that if they're trying to get blood You think about blood on an open wound, are you, Dr.
Yeah.
Michael? Yeah. So, and what they want is the female mozzies want the blood for the proteins so they can then make baby mozzies. And you'd think, well, why shove your beautifully evolved proboscis or is it, Nan, sorry, is it proboscis or proboscis? I don't know. What do you reckon, Zan?
I have no idea.
Neither do I. Yeah, that thing, the pointy thing, right?
Someone texted us in. Is it proboscis or proboscis?
Okay, so they've got this beautifully evolved thing which has got a series of pipes, some carrying liquid this way, some carrying that way. It's an amazingly wonderful thing. And you're thinking, why bother if there's just some blood on the surface? Why not just go for the blood? And the answer is they don't have enough brain power to go down that pathway. They're sort of like an evolved machine with a reflex. Track you down by the carbon dioxide you're emitting first. The more carbon dioxide, the better. So if you're a bigger animal, you'll have more blood. And then go for the individual smells, which we don't fully understand yet. And then out with the proboscis or is. And I'm guessing that nowhere in there is a, and by the way, plan B, if there happens to be some open blood, I'll just go over there and slurp it. Or it could be that the only way they can get stuff into their gut is via the proboscis or kiss, and so slurping it up against some blood doesn't work. They've actually got to have penetrated the skin. We need an entomologist to give us an answer on that. It could, and that might be somebody like Professor Cameron Webb. That's as much as I know. I'm sorry, Dr. Michael, but it's a very deep question.
Thanks for the question, Michael.
Cool.
Thank you.
Text line says overwhelmingly proboscis, Dr.
Proboscis. Thank you so much.
Thank you for everyone texting in on 0439757555. We're taking your calls on 1300 055536. And Frankie is on the line calling in from Canberra. Hey, Frankie, what's your question?
Hey, I've got a question about good old bananas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a chef and sometimes want to make something out of bananas. We want them to be super ripe, and obviously we can't always get our hands on them. I've been told that if you freeze them, they'll develop more flavour and perhaps ripen whilst in the freezer. So two-part question, why would that happen? And also, if it does, which is awesome, do I peel them or do I not?
Right. I would suggest going down the pathway of doing the experiment. And what you need to do is get a bunch of bananas at pretty well off the same hand, that is a technical term, and then try them two at a time in different environments. My understanding was that they ripened, okay, firstly, a bit of a backup, they are what are called a climacteric fruit, C-L-I-M-A-C-T-E-R-I-C, which means that they're harvested when unripe or green, and then they continue to ripen based on their surrounding climate, which can be the inside of a paper bag where the carbon, no, sorry, they give off a gas called ethylene. They give off this gas called ethylene, and that ripens them. And so if you have a bunch of bananas together, not only will they ripen each other by the gas they give off, but they'll also ripen any other fruit you have in there.
So would that gas be coming from the skin, though?
Yeah.
Oh, hang on. It would be. So I wouldn't. Oh, sorry. Okay, I'm getting excited.
Oh,
look. I'm getting excited about my banana conundrum.
I'm into it.
Frankie, you've started me off. I read something in Choice magazine, and being lazy, I didn't follow it up, but it runs like this. There's a 2x2 grid of fruit that give off ethylene and don't, and are affected by it or not.
Yep.
In the same way with people who have asparagus and can generate and then can smell, there's a 2x2 grid. So I don't know where bananas fit on that, and I've got to chase up that article. So I don't know where it comes from. I'm guessing it has to come through the skin.
In terms of this fruit, actually, like just the ease of it, though, because sometimes I freeze bananas to then make them into smoothies, it is really hard
to peel
when they're frozen. So I don't know if that relates to the ripening, but definitely for ease, you peel those suckers before you put them in the freezer.
Yeah, right, but whether they'll ripen, though.
But Zan, have you noticed?
It sounds like I've an experiment on my hands.
Yeah, but have they? But Zan, do they ripen more quickly when you put them free of their skin into the freezer?
I haven't noticed.
We've
failed.
They go
Frankie.
Very black. They're really black. But okay. Well, I'll have to get into the freezer and get me some bananas going on.
Yeah, and can you call us back and let us know? And I'll go chasing up that article in Choice magazine and find out what is the truth of the 2x2 grid.
Thanks for the call, Frankie.
I'm on the
Thank you,
quest.
Dr. Frankie.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Frankie's on a banana quest. Let's go to Liam in the Gold Coast and find out what quest he's on. Hey, Liam, what's your question?
Morning, Dr. Carl, Dr. Dan.
Morning.
Dr. Liam.
Let's say I was travelling at 300 kilometres an hour and say a bullet travels at 300 kilometres an hour.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if I shot the bullet the opposite way I was travelling?
If you turned out the back of the train or car and fired the bullet, you would see the bullet leave your gun at 300 kilometres an hour But somebody at the side of the road would just see the bullet go pop and just fall onto the ground in front of them.
Oh, very good.
So your forward velocity would scrub out the backward velocity of the bullet. Yes, and I think Mythbusters have done this in some very elegant experiments.
Thanks for the call, Liam.
Thank you.
Let's head now to Lorenzo, calling in from Melbourne. Hey, Lorenzo, what's your question?
Morning, doctors.
Morning.
Dr. Lorenzo.
All righty, I've got a question about the pyramids, ancient Egypt. Now, from an engineering and physics standpoint, how would they have transported the massive amounts of rock from, say, a quarry site to where the site of the pyramids are? And once there, how would they have been able to bring them up to the level that the pyramids are without the modern technologies that we have today?
Rollers and ramps. And people have done this as part of theses. There's a whole field of knowledge called Egyptology, believe it or not, and a subset of that is the pyramid building. And there are people who have spent their whole lives working on it. And basically you need the population of the farming population of Egypt back then in the non-agricultural time of the year when they're not growing anything, and then put them to work, and 20 years labor will build you a nice small pyramid. Longo will build you a bigger one. So rollers and ramps. And what we've done is we've found remnants of the rollers. The ramps got taken away. But we've also found the villages where the workers would come to live for several months of the year, then go away. And written documentation of people working and doing stuff and then getting sick and having to be let off and how much they got paid. So it's a fairly straightforward but big problem in engineering, but it's solvable.
Thanks for the call, Lorenzo.
Cheers, guys.
We're having a lot of texts in about bananas and freezing as well. A lot of people saying that they do definitely get a lot sweeter after freezing, Dr. Carl. Even more saying, yes, definitely peel them before you put them in. Impossible to get the peel off otherwise. Kaya has given us a call this morning, calling in from Queensland. Hey, Kaya, what's your question?
Morning, guys.
Morning.
I was just wondering, so I know that we've sent out messages into space, and I'm just really curious to know whether we've got anything back.
The closest we've got is something called the WOW signal, W-O-W, and we really don't know what it was, and it happened only once, and so far, basically, we got nothing. There's some guy who claims that he knows what it is, but he's wrong. So the answer is, I'm sorry, really, Kaya, I am hanging out to get a signal from them out there saying, we have the secret to having chocolate that doesn't make you sick, so you can live entirely on chocolate all day.
That's the great answer that you're hoping for, is it?
That's one of the great ones. The other one is how to travel faster than the speed of light, and the other one is how to have fusion engines, and the other one is immortality.
The other thing is, though, that, yeah, we could be, someone might have heard us, but they're trying to get the message back, aren't they, in terms of the time?
There could be time.
It's going to take to, you know, get back the light years in terms of how far away they are.
Sure. The main problem is the speed of light, and I think we'll get away around that. So Einstein tells us you can't travel faster than the speed of light. So if the nearest star is 4 light years away, it's going to take you a minimum of 4 years and probably 40 to get there. So there has to be a better way. The Alcubierre effect, A-L-C-U-B-I-E-R-R-E effect would work, but the trouble with that is that you destroy the incoming location as you come into it and slow down. Minor problem. We're still working on it.
Thanks for the call, Kaya.
Thank you, Dr. Kaya.
Let's head now to Nick, who's calling in from the Central Coast. Hey, Nick, what's your question?
Hey, Dr. Carl, Dr. Zan.
Definitely.
I, you know, when you eat too much sugary things or sour things, you get like a little ulcer on your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
It's painful and it lasts for a few days. Instead of dealing with that for a few days, I snip the tip of that off.
Oh, God, Nick!
What, do you use a chainsaw? What do you do, man?
Nah, just nail clippers.
Oh,
man!
I was just wondering. Well, then you don't have to deal with a painful thing on your tongue for a few days. It heals within like 10 minutes. I was wondering if that will eventually destroy my sense of taste or whether the tongue will regenerate.
The tongue's
worried that it's destroyed your dating life for the next year or so. But anyway, yeah. Dr. Carl?
Well, the tongue is one of the few muscles in the body that gets stronger with age. On the other hand, you've got all these nerve endings on there. And if you keep on snipping them off, I can't see that it would be good in the long run. Now, you may or may not have what are called aphthous ulcers. I'll spell that for you. A-P-H-T-H. OUS ulcers. And it's worthwhile just going to see your doctor and getting it on record to see if there's something else going on in the background. Certainly, you don't want to go through a binge and then starvation mentality where you have lots of sugar, then none for a while. That's not good. But in general, I think there's a reasonable risk. There are reasonable risk, maybe 20-50% that you could be damaging your long-term taste sensitivity. Definitely see your GP when you've got these ulcers up and ask for an opinion.
Thanks, I think, Nick. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Jeez. Is it true that the mouth is the fastest area of the body to heal, Dr. Carl? That's what I've heard through my life.
It does heal very quickly because the cells on the inside of your mouth have a very fast replacement time of the order of 1 to 2 days. So 1 to 2 days for your mouth, a little bit longer for your gut, 14 days for your skin, 10 years for your bone. The overall truth that everything takes 7 years to regenerate, that's just because somebody fell in love with the number 7.
Dr. Carl is with us. Truth bombs on a Thursday morning, 1-300-055-36 if you want one hurtled your way. And we're going to go now to Hayley, who's calling in from the Gong. G'day, Hayley. What's your question?
Hi, doctors. Hey, how are you?
Good.
I'm just ringing to ask about rocking. Like, I've noticed that it's really comforting for babies and people with anxiety, and I was wondering just what that is about.
I don't have the answer as to why we rock, and I'm sure the answer would be somewhere in Google Scholar, but it is very comforting. So next time you're watching something bad has happened on TV, like a train crash or an earthquake, if you look carefully in the background, you'll see that people are rocking backwards and forwards. So it provides comfort. If you do it for long enough and hard enough, it'll actually put you into a hallucinogenic state. And the so-called whirling dervishes, and I think they're a small branch of Islam where the men wear long skirts and they just whirl around for hours with the skirts virtually out horizontally, and they, after a couple of hours, are in quite a hallucinogenic state. It's definitely comforting. I don't know why. That's another bit of homework I'll have to do, which I'm not doing right now.
Yeah, but it exists, doesn't it? Thanks for the call. Real. Interesting question, Hayley. Thanks for the call.
Oh, yeah. I'll get back to rocking in the corner.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to Josh in Geelong right now. Hey, Josh.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
So, I'm a surfer, and in the cooler winter months, I noticed that long exposure in water, when you're out there, you sort of lose the ability to put your fingers together and kind of like a claw. And then you get out and get changed, and it's really hard to pick up objects or tie your shoes or kind of you just lose that motor skill. And I was wondering what's actually happening after such long exposure to the cold water.
So Josh is a surfer, if you just missed that at the start, Dr. Carl. What's going on with cold water and immobilising motor skills?
It's working at two ends. Firstly, on the sensory organs in your skin, and secondly, the motor response. So in your skin, you've got different receptors for fine touch and for blunt touch. And so, for example, one test for a diabetic is that you press on their foot and they say, can you feel it? Can you feel it? And then you get a very sharp pin, and you don't puncture the skin. You just sort of go bop, 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 bop. And as you come down the knee, it goes past the knee. They can feel it. You get halfway down the shin, and then you get sort of part of the way into the foot, and then suddenly they feel nothing. Those nerves have died forever. So in the case of being in the cold water, those nerves, the ones that give you the fine touch and then later the coarse touch, they all get temporarily anaesthetized. You're not going to lose them forever. You're just getting temporarily anaesthetized. And in general, a body part can stand about 6 hours of anaesthetic, of being knocked out, of not having oxygen, and still come back. Apart from your brain, your eye, and your heart. So you've got 6 hours. So firstly, the sensation's not going to your brain, so you don't have a sense of proprioception, fancy word, proprioception, or knowing where your joints are. The second half of it is the actual how the muscles work. And if you find a video of this on Wikipedia, it's fascinating. So imagine you've got two strands of barbed wire, and the wires have all got the little hooky things, and they've hooked into each other. And then the hooks go, instead of hooking downwards at each other, they go horizontal. They then reach out to the next hook, and then they pull themselves forward. and they sort of go ratchet, 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 and they pull themselves along. Mind you, they do this at enormous speed. So, for example, you're blinking an eye. This happens very quickly. So that also is slowed down simply by the cold because you are out of the normal operating region. Your heart and the inside of your body is at 37 degrees C, but you sacrificed the outside of your body because you want to keep as much heat as possible, and you're letting that go down temporarily out of its operating range. So the sensors go, and the motors also go to lunch.
Bloody cold water in Geelong right now at this time of year as well. Thanks for the call, Josh. Man,
thank you.
Getting a few texts in, one of which is a highlight for me. Yeah. Ellie, who is Nick, who just called in about clipping off his mouth ulcers, tongue ulcers. With clippers.
Yeah.
Can't believe he just called up with this grossest thing ever, says Ellie on the Central Coast. And a lot of other people are calling in about the rocking response and saying it could be mimicking the womb. That's someone else's idea that maybe it's something to do with the womb. Another person, Sophie, says, I'm an occupational therapist and I'm thinking the rocking may be a self-regulation tool using your vestibular system. Does that make any sense to you, Dr. Carl?
Yeah, so you're in a situation where your whole family has been destroyed, you're the only survivor, and you're just sitting out there and it's a cold night. If you can rock backwards and forwards, you control one small part of the universe.
Mm.
Backwards, forwards, backwards, forwards. And the longer you keep that up, the more you think, okay, this, I'm alive. I feel alive. At least I'm not totally out of control.
Wow. 1-300-055-536 is the number. If you've got a question for Dr. Carl, we'd love to hear it. John does, calling in from Maitland. Hey, John, what's your question?
Good morning, Dr. Zan. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Morning.
Mm.
I have a question for you, Carl, about sound. As a young many years ago, I noticed that sound seemed to travel better uphill than downhill. And recently the question came again, and I was talking to a friend about it, and he said, is that so? And I always wondered if it was actual a fact or not. So my question to you, Dr. Carl, is does sound travel better uphill or downhill? And if so, why?
Number one, dunno. Number two, I'm guessing downhill, because the sound has to propagate by bouncing into other air molecules. And we're assuming that you are doing it from the bottom of the mountain shouting up to the top and vice versa. So you've got whatever laminar or thin layer of air trapped close to the mountain in each case, so that doesn't make any difference. So the molecules have to go uphill, and that takes some energy out of them. So think of a long line of people in a queue at an ATM, and person one pushes two, who pushes three, who pushes four, and you just, that's not much energy. But imagine it's on a very steep hill. You're going to have to push harder to make them hit the next person uphill. On the other hand, air molecules are very light. I don't know if anybody has done the physics on this, but I'm guessing that it would not propagate as far uphill, and I reckon it's because the extra role that gravity has in robbing energy out of the system. But I don't know if this is true. If somebody could give us a tweet on that at DOCTORKRL or text in, what's the magic number, Dr. Zan?
0439 757 555. Yeah. Thanks, John. We'll see if we can get any more info for you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
See you later. Tim's calling in from Thirroul. Hey, Tim, what's your question?
Hi. Me and the boys are just having some lunch and we're debating whereabouts does the memory go when you delete it off your computer. Is it like a big cyber junk space thing, or is it just get deleted for good?
Good question.
The data stays there, but where the data is stored has gone. So imagine you've got a book with, say, 50 chapters. Chapter number one, how to listen to us on the radio. Chapter number two, listen to us on the radio more and more often. And all the way up to chapter number 50. Deleting stuff off your hard drive is equivalent to getting rid of the table of contents and saying, all those other things, you can just write anything you want on it. So if you delete stuff off your hard drive and then immediately give it to somebody else, they'll be able to get all of the data back. But if you just use that computer over the next day and week and month, gradually you'll write new data over what was there before. So there's three grades of getting rid of data properly, or actually four if you count the Australian military. Number one is that you, over all of the data that you've deleted, you write either zeros or ones in every single memory spot. And that'll take a certain amount of time. So the first three levels are you write on there once, you write zeros or ones, or you do it seven times, or if you want to go to full US military-grade safety, you do it 35 times. You write over the stuff on the hard drive 35 times, nobody is going to be able to get it back. We're talking about a spinning hard drive. Even if they use, and it's what they do used to use, an atomic force microscope. So just simple, quick delete does not get rid of the data, but eventually it'll vanish as other stuff gets written over it. The Australian military have a different way. They get their old computers, they take out the hard drives. They take the hard drives out of the cases, so they've got the magnetic platters. They then grind the military the magnetic platters, the spinning discs, into powder, and then mix this powder in with some concrete on a new building that they're making. Mate, you want to go and find a speck of a hard drive, 1/100th of a millimetre across, you go right ahead, right? So to answer your question, you don't truly delete it until you write over it at least once.
Thanks for the call, Tim.
Awesome, no worries, thanks for that.
Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Do you remember when you pimped my new computer and you transferred all the data and you erased, I think you did like a 35-time thing so that you could get rid of all my data when you pimped my new computer, Carl?
Yes, and also I made sure that I did not write, I wrote down your password and gave it to you and have no memory of what it is as a good IT officer. And I'm trying to train the family into being IT officers but having difficulty. Oh, by the way.
You're very good with computers. I appreciated that.
Well, it was. I like doing that sort of stuff. And now I've got a tweet here from somebody saying, winds, you were talking about the sound going up and down a hill, winds tend to flow uphill during the day and downhill at night. And so that would, if the wind is flowing uphill, that'll carry the sound further in the day. And if it's going downhill, that'll fight it. So that's another factor to bring into it besides just the gravity. Thank you very much, Jake van den Broek.
Let's go now to Reza calling in from Perth. Or is it Reza?
Reza.
Reza. Hi, Reza. Hello, Reza. What's your question?
Well, hi, Dr. Carl. I've got a question. Is time a perception or is it a reality?
We didn't know for sure until Einstein. And then around 1905, he said that you've got these three dimensions of space, backwards, forwards, left, right, up, down, and married in with them is another dimension called time that is different from the left, right, up, down, backwards, forwards, but is married and intermingled and real.
Yeah. Okay.
So according to Einstein, it is real, but there's still mysteries. How come it only flows forward? Nowhere do we see an egg unscrambling itself or your dirty clothes spontaneously getting clean and putting themselves back in the cupboard. So we don't know that. There's still mysteries.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking this is years ago I came across a book discussing an Iranian philosopher who lived in 1600 and he was studying the nature of motion in general. And basically came to the conclusion that the time, matter, and change are all one and the same thing.
Wow.
And basically he came to the conclusion pretty much close to Einstein that my understanding was the internal clock. So he believed that everything's changing, and that's why we have everything, including energy. And that's why... And pretty much time is the measure of change.
It is, but since then we've acquired a lot more, ways of, new ways of making discoveries, new instruments, and we've made many, many discoveries. And if that philosopher was around today, I could see them as a top scientist and saying, oh, wow, this all makes sense. Let me think about it. Wow. But unfortunately, he didn't have all the data that we have today.
Yeah, that would be interesting. What you would have said.
Thanks so much for the call, Reza.
Okay, no worries.
See you later. Let's head now to Cal calling in from Newcastle. Hey, Cal.
How are we going?
Good. What's your question?
Just in regards to the Sheila ringing up earlier in the signals that we sent out to Spain.
Sheila. Wow. Sheila. I haven't heard that one since the 70s. Go on.
Yeah.
In regards to that, what signals did we send? I'm guessing they'd be in light, and how do we expect them to be interpreted, received, and translated into whatever catches these signals?
Well, a few people thought about that with the Voyager 1 spacecraft, and they put, under Carl Sagan's leadership, a bunch of symbols onto gold plates on the outside of the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecraft. And they deal with a certain number of things that are fixed in the universe, whether you live in air, water, or rock, or vacuum, and whether you breathe or not, or whether you have arms or not. There's always going to be the same ratio of a circle's diameter to its circumference. Pi is real everywhere else in the everywhere in the universe. Hydrogen has two atoms. It has the same shape. And so they've incorporated that with a map of pulsars with their different distances away from us and how quickly they oscillate, how quickly they flash on and off. And so they've got some basic stuff like pi is always 3.14, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you look at it and you sit down for half a day, you think, wow, I can actually turn that back into English, and it doesn't matter whether you're a human or an alien. You can still do it.
Yeah, well, thanks for that.
Thanks so much for the call, Carl.
Thank you, Dr.
No worries, have a good one.
See you later. And that's about all the time we have this morning, but good news, Dr. Carl will be up on your podcast. As I mentioned, wherever you get your podcast, just search for Dr. Carl. And this Science Hour, minus the songs, will be there for you to listen to in your pocket whenever you like. On a road trip, it's all yours, it's all free. So do subscribe if you haven't already. Dr. Carl, will we see you next week?
I'd love that so much.
Bye.